Welcome to today's episode of Fire in the Belly. This is where we get to hear some pretty inspiring stories from some amazing people. You know, it's always an absolute pleasure to sit down, take time out, and have a warts and all conversation about their journey. I'm always intrigued by what it's taken for people to get to where they are today. And hopefully, in this interview, we get to hear some more about that. From this, my mission is to help people to find their own fire in their belly, and from that, to live the mightiest version of you. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy today's guest. Success is a process, not an event. Hello and welcome to Fire in the Belly. Today we have myself, Mighty Pete, and we have Elliot Kay, and I'm delighted to have you on the show, Elliot. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, listen, it's great. So Elliot, tell us, who are you, what are you doing, where are you from?
Those are very different questions, aren't they? Who are you, what are you doing, where are you from? Where do we start? So who am I? Well, my name is Elliot Kay, and I am the co-founder of Speaker Express. I work with business owners and entrepreneurs to help them win more business through the utilization of public speaking as a marketing strategy. I'm a two-time best-selling author. I'm an international speaker. Above everything else, I am a dad and a husband. Those are the leading. That's what leads me. That's what gets me out of bed every day. We talked about waking up. So that's what gets me waking up most days. And my two beautiful children, my beautiful wife. I'm born in London, North London. So, you know, diehard Arsenal fan, of course. There is the only mighty red in North London. And who am I? I mean, I think we're going to unpack that throughout the podcast a little bit. But that's what I do. And I mean, more than anything, if you really ask me who I am, I believe I'm a man that has its own conflicts, its own demons, has been through depression and come out on the other side. My ambition in life, more than anything, is to be a great father, to be a great husband, and to truly impact the entrepreneurial community to use their voice for good. Because we do an exercise when we train about who are you really, and that's who am I really.
That's all. It's interesting. That's future language you're using as well, you know, sort of a want to be a father. Yes. Or the best father, things like that. So future pacing there a lot, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, like anything, I believe we work in progress, aren't we? And every day I show up the best dad, the best husband I can be. That doesn't mean I am the best dad, the best husband. And I think it's a continuous aspiration, because if I ever feel like I've arrived, now I'm the best, well, where do you go from there? You know?
Are you happy with your success, where you're at today? I mean, is that something that feels good to you?
It's a very interesting question, because I think in the current situation we're in, I think there's so many challenges and variables beyond our control. So I know it's the whole we can control the controllables, and the controllables are us, right? However, right now, I mean, I'm kind of in the bracket of the excluded lot from the government support and all that, which is fine because that's part of being an entrepreneur. But when you feel that you're continuously being pushed down, regardless of being a cause and effect and things like that, it can be quite challenging to find that positivity while it's there. And I do find it. That doesn't mean I don't go through my ups and downs. So to answer your question right now, because what's going on with the economy and the market and who I work with, it's a very challenging time. I am very happy with my successes to a certain point. Do I feel that right now the business is a reflection of the success I want it to be? No, if I'm being completely honest and transparent. Am I happy that my two children are very smiley, happy and loving, and that there's a roof over my head and our heads, and there's food, and we're not short? Yes, I consider that a success. Someone asked me this on a podcast the other day, what's my definition of success? And I said, as long as my kids are smiling, it's a success. So in that respect, yes, but I clearly desire a lot more for the business. I want a lot more in terms of success, because I want to provide more, not buy more, just be able to offer more for our kids and our future and things like that. Does that answer your question?
It does. And slight disassociation there. I mean, I'm curious, would you say you like yourself? Do you love yourself?
I do like myself. I do love myself. That doesn't mean I always get on with myself. That doesn't always mean I agree with myself. And that doesn't mean I'm not often conflicted with myself. But in terms of who I see in the mirror and who I look at every day, I'm very happy with him and me. The two of us, the three of us, the many of us that are in there, the higher powers, the inner wisdom, the conflict, the shouting, the ego, we're all in there somewhere, right? Yeah, I accept them all. I accept myself for my imperfections. You know, I accept who I'm becoming. You know, I'm turning, I guess, middle-aged in my next birthday. I accept all that. I'm okay with that. I'm not fussed as much. I think if I was fussed, maybe I'd get rid of my dad bod a little bit more. Not that it's big, but, you know, it's just a little bit of a dad bod. But, you know, I do accept and appreciate and love myself.
I'm assuming when you could say middle age, we're hitting 40, is that right?
45.
Very good. So I think it's great. Like, I mean, once you 40 plus, you can kind of go on, hold on, I have a bit of poetic license to kind of do what I want now, right? You know, you're dangerous because you've got a few pounds in your pocket and you've got over what other people used to think about you, right? So life's a bit different.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things I've never really cared too much about what people think about me. I care about what people think about the business. I care about what people think about my services. I'm not too fussed what people think about me. I mean, you know, I'm about to launch a whole campaign called Be More Giraffe. I'm about to do two talks dressed in a giraffe onesie. So clearly there's some not caring there. But yeah, you know, I think this is also the age we become really sexy, right? 40 plus, you know, dad bod, that's in. You know, girls like, ooh, he's older. Not that I'm in any way interested in anyone else, just for the record. But, you know, it's just nice to know that there's an attraction beyond a certain age that people might just find you attractive. That's nice to know.
So would you say you're where you're supposed to be at this time then? Is that a fair wrap up?
That comes back to my original point when we started to talk about happiness around success, right? Again, to be completely transparent and honest, I am not happy with where we are right now. I want to be further along the line, again, because of the year we've all had. So I'm not special, right, Anna? We've all had a challenging year. Unless you're in the takeaway industry, tech, providing communication platforms, you know, of course, those industries are booming. If I look at the business to where, of course, the ambitions were at the beginning of the year when I raised investment and the ambitions I had to scale and things like that to where it is now, I'm not happy. And I'm just being very honest with you and very transparent. I could give you the Hollywood answer. Yeah, everything's great. Oh, my God, everything's flowing in and it's all brilliant. And people are landing in my lap and I booked up. But that's not the truth, right? And, you know, if we talk about being accepting and real to ourselves, then I have to be honest with you and tell you, no, I'm not happy with where the business is. I want it to be further on the line. I want it to be have a greater profile. I want a lot more. And I want it, I believe, for the right reasons. It's not because of greed. It's because I want to be able to serve better. So the answer to your question is no, I'm not very happy with where the business is.
Fair play. Listen, I appreciate your honesty. I mean, that's all we can ask for, really. So it's fantastic. Do you know your superpower, Elliot? Do you know where you're at?
Yes. Well, two questions. My superpower is my ability to articulate and communicate what people need to express when they're talking about their products and services or when they're talking about their message. That's without a doubt, I've been told many a times, is my superpower. I'm also highly intuitive. I get a real gut feel for things. And lately it's been on fire and it's been right most times. I can't say it's been right every time, but it's been right most times. So I think more than anything is my ability to articulate what people want to communicate is my superpower. Besides my ability to fly and dress up as Batman and be a giraffe. Those, I think, are great superpowers.
The giraffe alone is a superpower in itself.
It really is. Just for reference.
Why? Oh yeah, I love it.
Just in case you didn't believe me.
Why a giraffe?
Well, because here's an interesting. So we're launching a whole campaign called "Be More Giraffe." I stand head above the rest because when we did the research with our clientele, what's your biggest challenge right now? It's to rise above the noise. And then I was experimenting with some new content in this mastermind I'm a part of. And I have a giraffe thing in the office. And I just went, you know, da, 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 be more giraffe. And I put the giraffe in. I was like, oh, my God, such a great idea. And I started to play with be more giraffe. And then I put it to the team, like, oh my God, it's just a whole marketing campaign about Be More Giraffe. So that's how Be More Giraffe. And it's light, it's fun, but with a serious message. And we're testing it right now. And I'll let you know tomorrow when I've done two talks just as a giraffe, how it actually went down.
Love it.
But that's why Be More Giraffe.
Mm. That's true, isn't it? I mean, and as you say, there is so much noise at this time, you know, good, bad, and different, you know, and probably no different to speaking, right? I mean, there's no shortage of people wanting to speak, but how do you stand out?
It's a great question. Yes, there's lots of people wanting to speak, and a lot of people think that speaking is an easy way to make money. And I think you and I know that's a bit like saying, oh, all I need to do is put a podcast out there and millions of people will listen to me and I'll make loads of money from the sponsorship. Not quite the case. There are a lot of speakers out there. There's some great speakers. There's some terrible speakers. The way you stand out, I believe there's several factors. One, you've absolutely got to know who you want to speak in front of, right? You've got to nail your market. And when I say your market, not your audience, your market are those who are going to buy from you. The market will clap you and adore you and share your picture on social media, but your market's the one that's going to spend money, right? That's crucial. Know who you want to speak in front of. Second is have absolute clarity in the appropriate language that resonates with your ideal audience. So you know your market, but then you need to know how to talk to them, how to communicate with them, how to communicate the problem, how to communicate your solution, but in the way they understand it, right? Because a mistake a lot of people make is they go, well, I've got this amazing service. I've got this great podcast, Brian LaBelle. And what I do, and what I believe it solves, you need to communicate in the way that your market can relate. So it's almost like you're in their head. So that's another thing you need to be doing to stand out from the noise. You need to be a great storyteller, right? You've got to be able to communicate stories to emphasize why you're that go-to product, service, or brand. And it doesn't matter if you're a techie, if you're a website developer, if you're a graphic designer, a consultant, a trainer, a coach, an author, a CEO, founder, it's all the same, right? And you've got to be able to deliver with impact. You've got to be memorable because, you know, it's that old cliche, people won't remember what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel, right? And so your ability to tell great story, to have great content that's current. Here's another mistake people make. They stick to the same old content that isn't current. We've changed. The world has changed. And if you're still talking about the stuff you talked about even 6 months ago, you might be out of date, especially in the speaking world. And there's a real shift in the speaking world because people are looking for experts that speak and not speakers anymore. That's a real shift. And those are some of the ways you stand out. And I think, you know, the little things do matter now, like the technology you use, right? The right microphone, the headphones, the backgrounds, all these things really matter now. The days of just having those tiny headsets and think like, I can tell you're not pro. I can tell you're not taking this seriously if you're going to do a whole hour's presentation plugged in with two headphones and a tiny iPhone kind of mic thing. Yeah, it's those are the kind of key components to stand out and be more giraffe.
It's so true, isn't it? I suppose... One policy, and I try and get across to any guest that come on, and you want to say it in a nice way, is going, but be a good guest, right? You know, right. Turn up, be present, get the microphone, do that, because nobody wants to hear the dog barking, or as you say, the really poor quality and the phone that's propped up against the window, and you know, it's all that, right? You know, so it's presence is everything.
Yeah, and it all matters, right? The detail matters now. I think at the beginning of this whole lockdown and pandemic, the detail didn't matter. But as this has become a way of doing things, a way of doing business, a way of winning clientele, the detail matters. Like you say, the type of mic, the dog in the background. People were forgiving, and I think now people are going, I'm not so forgiving anymore, especially when I'm giving up 45 minutes or an hour to hear you speak. It's not okay that your dog's barking in the background, dog. I mean, my daughter, she's almost four and she loves coming in to say hello. She loves it. And I'll always make it a part of the talk. She's cute, so she can get away with it. But if it's really, really important, then I make sure she stays away, right? Detail matters. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. Mm. And these things really count.
That's true. I mean, you wouldn't listen to a crackly radio, right? You know, it's like no matter how good the content.
Exactly.
That's getting turned off.
Yeah. And people, I think people were more forgiving visually than they are audio wise, but even so now I think that does matter, the quality of your picture.
Absolutely. So tell us, what does fire in the belly mean to you? I mean, what is that concept strike out for you?
Fire in the belly is very interesting because it means that inner drive, that inner passion, that inner fight to achieve something. That's what it, and you know, like if I look through my kind of my decades in the 20s, I had this fire in the 20s, when in my 20s, I had this fire in my belly to be, you know, a really established professional dancer. That was my fire in my belly. And then in my 30s, it was about being, you know, the best trainer and then becoming the best coach in the, you know, in the UK. And when I look at the 40s, my fire in my belly is to build something that I can hand my kids, you know, my legacy. I've got this vision for K Enterprises and I have a vision of handing it over to them and giving them something that will outlast me and will provide them and hopefully their kids' kids. And I suppose that's why I'm not happy with where I am right now in the business, because that feels very far away right now. But it's that inner fight, that passion, that drive. And, you know, I mean, I run a lot and we've just moved to Devon and there's loads of hills. And there's this one hill that I ran up on Saturday and almost threw up when I got to the top, because it's so different, my running right now, to what I used to run. And again, I've got fire in my belly that I'm going to own that hill. Like, I'm going to make that hill my mistress. Like, she is, I'm going to take her, I can't say take her down, but I'm going to take her up, right? So do you see what I mean? That comes from your fire in the belly.
It is that sort of trying to be, you know, the best you can be, and you're just competing against yourself, right?
Yeah, continuously. But it's also, I think, It's got a real force, a moving forwards force. It's got a real drive, it's got a real passion, it's got a real purpose when you've got fire in your belly. I think I've always had that, even in, you know, again, looking between, like, in my teenagers, I had fire in my belly to achieve something in life.
What are we looking at then? I mean, when we're looking at sort of mini Elliot, what would we have seen?
At what point of my life?
You tell me.
Very different. Very, very different, you know. So if we look at the mini Elliot, like 16, short hair, you know, shirts, bit chavvy, bit dangerous, you know, 17, long hair rocker, you know, big into heavy metal, big boots, wore only black. Then at 21, you're seeing the dancer emerge, you know, the late dancer that lasted almost till I was 30. Yeah, and then I think the evolution into the entrepreneur, into the caring, loving, accepting man that I became, which then allowed me to become a partner and a father. So it really does depend where you want to go. Like, there's many different evolutions to Elliot. And we can, you know, if we go back to pre-teens, then there's a very lost, very lonely, very kind of like separate Elliot. I think that Elliot's always kind of somewhere near me as well. Every now and then he pops up and says, hey, still here sometimes. Go, oh, welcome. It's okay. Thanks for showing up.
Do you remember when really that split happened?
When they show up or when I felt very isolated?
Yeah, the isolation, the sort of the you and then the isolated you sort of almost took separate.
Oh, well, I mean, growing up was fairly isolated. My dad, he's now recovering because I'm an alcoholic. My mom was a workaholic. My brother really didn't like me, you know, 4 years between us. He's very, I mean this in the nicest way, he's very British, so he's very reserved. He doesn't show emotion. He's not very warm. And then along I came, this loud, scratchy, asthmatic, eczema, got a kid that was screaming, was ill all the time. So as I grew up, I kind of was very, I felt very not a part, you know, even of course we were a family, we were very disjointed. And then when I was six, my family, they got divorced, right? My parents got divorced. And again, that was the period where divorce wasn't cool and it didn't happen every other day. I was dyslexic. Again, in a period where dyslexia wasn't really, you know, well known, I was just called lazy and I couldn't read. And so there's loads going on. So there's a big apartment of my growing up that I never really fit in. I never really was cool because I always had something up, right? I had glasses, they're very thick. And again, that was a period where glasses weren't cool and you were laughed at, called four eyes, things like that. So I think the real change for me came when I was about 15 or so, and this guy sat me down, just had a real heart-to-heart with me and said, look, I know you're a great guy, you know, but you got to stop being such an a-hole. You need to stop hating the world. And I think that's when I really kind of started to look at myself and how I was behaving and kind of made the effort to fit in and to be cool and stop having knife fights and, you know, going around almost getting myself arrested and things like that. And then, of course, once I changed that, then people changed how they viewed me. And then I think by the time I was 16, I was really cool. I had like my own phone line in my house. And, you know, again, we didn't have mobiles back then yet. Not far off. And, you know, I had a really cool social circles. And but even within then, I have a, sometimes when things aren't going well, I go to that kind of like, you know, it's only me, why me kind of space, a little bit of the victim. And I don't think I really owned that till the year 2010. Like it wasn't dominant, but every now and then I'd pop out. And then 2020 is where like I had my big life-changing moment, which is, you know, I had my best year in my business. And then I did what every sensible man does, is I followed a woman to Australia. And then it all fell apart in Australia. I mean, I was in love with her. We were kind of, we weren't really together, if you know what I mean. But, you know, I thought we would be. And then she kind of was like, hey, by the way, there's this billionaire that can really give me what I need. So, sorry, I don't have time for you right now. My property in Cardiff, you know, it was post 2008. So the bank actually were like, hey, we don't believe you're going to make payment. So we're calling in the mortgage. So you need to sort this out. I lost all by one of my clients with my coaching practice. At the time, I was known as the coach with a hat. I was doing fairly well with that. And I fell into like a massive dispute with this other company that was being there, you know, doing this selling for. They didn't pay me. So suddenly I found myself from the best month to the worst month with no money, no income. And I think that's when I really had to overcome this whole I'm separate, I'm not a part of, the universe is leaving me out kind of thing. And that's when I really kind of took ownership of it. And I dealt a lot with, you know, my relationship, my relationship with money, my relationship with myself, my relationship, you know, I was sexually abused when I was really young, when I was 12, I also was sexually abused. And I finally really dealt with that and found forgiveness. And then since then, I really haven't had that kind of like isolated, it's only happened to me every now and then. It pops up and goes, hey, and go, hi, and it goes back down again. Yeah. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it was lots there. Well, thank you for sharing. You know, it's I mean, how does the isolation serve you, just out of interest?
I mean, again, I think sometimes when I've gone to that space, I've kind of rekindled that fire in my belly. Like, you know, I found that, it's like, that's it, I'm going to prove them wrong, suck the world, blah, blah. Do you know what I mean? I go to that kind of like angry, you know, Batman space. Like, let me get my Batmobile and take out all the baddies, right? I think it served me in that respect. I think it kind of also is a space I would go to process. Right. So I'd go away to process what's going on. So, and I still do that, but not in the way of feeling isolated and cut off. But I feel that's how it served me. And it allowed me to kind of, you know, back then feel a bit sorry for myself. And I feel that's how it worked.
Because I'm always curious, and you know, there's a question I've sort of posed even to myself and a few others is, you know, meditation and depression or isolation all have the same properties, if you like, but yet have completely different charges, different intentions.
Yeah, absolutely. When I do meditate now, I've just rekindled my relationship with meditation. I have been through depression when I was 42. I had 9 months of really bad depression. And isolation. I think, you know, it's okay to, you see, now I'm I'm okay with the time I spend on my own. I really enjoy it. But the difference is it's not done from a pull me, I'm being cut out space. It's going, I need my own time. I need my downtime. So they are very different. Meditation, actually, well, it depends on the meditation. There's so many. I mean, right now when I meditate before I go to sleep, it's just to kind of, the particular song I listen to, it does something in my brain. And I just feel this calm connection. I literally feel it in my brain. It's not just a metaphor. I literally feel it go through me. And then I have a good one half of the night's sleep. And then the second half isn't as good. But that's another thing. Yeah, and depression, I think, you know, what's interesting, having been through seriously, seriously bad depression a couple of years ago, it is very isolating. And the reason, and my wife didn't know what was going on. No one around, my business partner at the time, did not know what was happening. Because I was functional. It wasn't like I stayed in bed and didn't get out of bed. You know, I kind of knew what was going on, and I made myself certain rules. Never let anyone down, get out of bed every day, wash, brush your teeth. And in a way, having the business made me get out of bed. Because if I wasn't going to get out of bed, I'd be letting people down. And that was my one kind of rule to myself through fighting this. What was really isolating was the inability to express what was going on. I couldn't tell my wife. It wasn't like I didn't want to, but I couldn't really articulate what exactly was going on. Plus, you know, you don't really want to tell people you're having, you know, it's very hard to tell people you're having really dark thoughts and you're thinking of suicide. And, you know, and when you're already quite, and again, depression is very selfish. It's very inward. Which is exactly what you want to do, but you withdraw, you pull in. And because I couldn't quite articulate, I couldn't express myself, I couldn't really share what was going on, I said nothing. And it went on for months. And then eventually my soul exploded, and that's what led me to deal with it.
I'm just curious. I mean, I know with depression, even for myself there, I mean, I've come to the stage now of talking about depression as a symptom, not necessarily a cause. What would be your take on that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, I can literally remember. So it's my 42nd birthday, and I woke up in the shoulding. I should have a bigger house. I should be making more money. I should be further along the line. And because I don't coach anymore, but I'm a trained coach, NLP, EFT, all these techniques, I thought I'd dealt with it. I thought I'd reframed it. I thought I'd collapsed it. I thought I'd let go of it. And it just didn't go away. And what was running below a lot of this was a comparison program. I was comparing. You know, comparison is a thief of joy. And comparison, you compare to despair because it's never good enough. So underlying all that was a lot of comparison, was a lot of self-worth issues. I had my little girl was, I think she would have been 2 at the time. You know, and I think there was a lot of issues with self-worth of what kind of dad I'm going to be. Am I going to be a good enough dad? Can I be the dad she needs me to be? And with that all playing on my mind, plus running a strategy business at the time, serving clients who... some are getting results, a lot aren't getting results. And, you know, you're dealing with it's your fault. I'm not getting results, which you and I know that often not the case. But when you combine all that together, it made for some pretty dark places to go in your head. But no one really knew. That's the other thing. It was it's a very lonely condition. It's not like you get together and have depressed parties, you know. Let's all get depressed together and hang out. It just doesn't happen. Yeah, so I agree. It's a symptom versus the cause.
And is it so? And I've always been struck, and I know probably for myself, but speaking to others, in one in particular interview where she was saying there was an attempted suicide. And just very matter of fact, you know, this is what it was, didn't work out, and you know, didn't sort of for various reasons. So went to bed, got up the next morning, made breakfast, and carried on with the day. You know, right. And that's what I'm just saying is like, you know, did anyone know? And they're like, no.
No, exactly.
It's just, I don't know. I just thought that sort of blew my mind, the fact of going, I'll make the kids lunches. I'll do this, this, and this, and try and commit suicide. Didn't work out. Okay, next.
Let's crack on. You just carry on. At least that person just carried on versus like took that even further. Like, oh my God, I can't even kill myself. You know, it's like that can be quite a horrible blow. I never attempted it, but it certainly crossed my mind. And, you know, when you're driving, when you're doing, you're kind of like, part of you's going, oh, well, what if I had an accident? That wouldn't be too bad, would it? It's that kind of thought, which you and I know it's not. It's not great. But that's just where you are. And there's nothing worse than people going, oh, well, it's just your brain playing tricks on you. It's like, you clearly don't get depression. I mean, yes, is it? Maybe it's a chemical imbalance. Maybe. But that doesn't take away from the reality you're living in at the time.
And it's hard too, right? Because, I mean, you're obviously educated and well-trained, and it's almost like the more you know, the more frustrating it becomes, because you kind of go, well, in this next book will give me the answer that I'm looking for, right?
Next book, next video, next song, you're looking for it everywhere, right? Mm. And I think that's the other thing. I think the industry that I was in at the time, and when you're like, you've done coaching and all that, it almost adds pressure. It's like, oh, why am I here? I've got all these tools. I shouldn't be feeling this. I should be like on top of the world. And it just doesn't work that way. But you kind of feel like, no, I need to be Superman. Come on, I've got all these tools. I should be deal. I used to teach people how to overcome this stuff. I've helped people away from suicide. Da, 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 da. Why is this happening to me? And I think that adds a layer of pressure that you don't need. And you shouldn't, because you are human, and it doesn't matter if you're a coach or a ninja or whatever, you're going to have down days, and you're going to have days where you need to deal with what's going on in your head emotionally, with the imbalances and things like that. There was that added pressure I put on myself, because I can't be seeing this back. It's just BS. You and I know it's BS.
So why are you speaking? Where did that all come about?
Well, speaking has been there for a decade, quite interestingly enough. So when I was training, I used to work for some really big companies. I used to do their training. I wanted to be a better trainer. And then I looked at all these qualifications and I came across coaching. So I started coaching, and I really fell in love with coaching at the time, because I could have a direct impact on people's lives. And I was like, wow, this is amazing versus corporate training, which was fun, but not amazing. And then what happened was I went to a seminar, 5,000 people in a room in Ali Pali in London. And I was like, wow, this guy's brilliant. It wasn't Tony Robbins, just FYI. It was someone else. And I was like, I can do that. The typical, I can do that. And I did. And then so I started to speak. And then I enrolled in speaking training. And then I realized how much there really is to speaking. You know, I was that guy. I go, how hard can it be to speak? You know, I can speak. And then like, oh, my God, it's really hard. And then, you know, to do an impact, to be a great storyteller, to be able to sell and enroll people to buy from you. But, you know, one thing that's been the consistent method of marketing for the last decade has been speaking. So speaking is always, when I was the coach with a hat and we run Power to Succeed, I use speaking to promote it. And then when I moved to my strategy stuff, I use speaking. And now with Speaker Express, obviously, but I've always been involved in Speaker Express for almost a decade as well. So speaking's always been there, because it's one of the most efficient and effective tools you have at your disposal to promote your business, your brand, your product, yourself. You don't have to necessarily pay to put you're speaking, you know, it's not like putting Facebook ads or anything. You can, and with the platforms that are now available, you can speak most places, anywhere. And if you do it well, you enroll people. And it is right now the most important tool that you have at your disposal to help yourself in this current environment. And speaking is so powerful. Literally, you know, there's a reason why Dale Carnegie said that it's the biggest magnifying glass that you could ever look at, right? It is a metaphor for life. you know, it is transformational when people master speaking. And that's why speaking.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, I suppose it's impossible. I'm saying is, I'm curious, and this was, well, I have a TEDx speak talk coming up for myself. And it's always curious when you look at, you know, I don't know who said it, and you may know better. It's kind of going, if you want me to talk all day, then let's go. If you, you know, if you want me to talk for 2 hours, give me a week. If you want me to talk for an hour, give me a month. And if you want me to talk for 10 minutes, give me 3 months, right? It's sort of, yeah. It's harder to say less than it is to say more.
Yeah, and because we have a tendency to over-explain, right? And that's what I mean. Part of the stuff we do is training people to be able to deliver succinctly their core message in 20 seconds or 30 seconds. You should be able to explain what you do in 20 to 30 seconds. And that, as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, right? Even as a storyteller, whatever it is, you should be able to very clearly, very easily, succinctly be able to explain that. In 10 minutes, what happens is people feel that they have to pad it out so much. And you've got to remember that less is more, right? You're better off drilling one or two key points than five very fast ones. And that's why a lot of people struggle with 10 minutes, you know, because I was working with someone recently. She had to do 3 minutes for this presentation to get onto this, you know, potential accelerator that she'd get 20 grand and things like that. And she really struggled. I'm like, no, you can remove that. And, you know, you don't need that. But this need to over justify is why people struggle with short bursts.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how we communicate? And is that, I'm curious about the key of a good speech. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, it's got to be real, it's got to be genuine, it's got to be authentic, right? Is that a fair point?
Yeah, I think people underestimate the importance of structure as well. I think people mistake structure for script, and they're very different. Yeah, it's got to be real. It's got to be authentic. It's got to be genuine. It's got to be current. You know, it's got to be relevant. You've got to deliver it with impact. But that's what structure allows you to do. When you have a solid structure, it allows you to play with it, but still know where you want to end up. You know, if you look at some of the great speeches, they all had structure, right? Martin Luther King had done that speech over 1,000 times. He tested different parts. In fact, the opening, when he said, "I had a dream," was because someone yelled it from the crowd, you know, because they'd heard him say it before and he wasn't sure what the opening line would be. But he knew where he wanted to go, and then he did channel a lot of it and he did go off script, but he knew where he wanted to go, right? And what was very unique about, for example, that particular speech is because there was lots of speeches around that time saying the same thing, but what he really used was language that lands. That's what I'm talking about, using the right language to enroll people into. So structure is really important. You know, when Emma Watson, Harry Potter, yes, went to the UN, she didn't just suddenly rely on her charisma and her charm to execute a very important speech. And I think people underestimate the importance of having a structure. And then they go, but wouldn't that restrict my expression? I'm like, no, it doesn't. We're not talking about scripting your talk. We're talking about giving it structure. And there's very simple structures that can be very impactful. And I think that's where a lot of people, they have that missing ingredient, is structure.
That's a very good point. You know, there's nothing worse, I suppose. You take it to a wedding or something else, throw a couple of drinks in and go on. You know, they stand up and go on, I haven't prepared a speech. But that's, I'm going to speak anyway.
Yeah, people, you know, you can feel people, ugh. Unless you're very, very naturally good, which is very, very rare. Mm. Some people can do it, but not a lot of people can.
Mm. Talk to us about, you know, really through, you talked about, you know, being in sort of sales, I think, you know, you're saying, and through sort of your early career, if you like. And well, you were saying there was a lot of, you know, professional dancer there as well. What sort of dance were you into?
So at the age of 21, I decided I want to become a professional dancer. So I left university after 2 years and pursued that. And I trained at Northern School of Contemporary Dance in Leeds. And that was, again, that was quite life-changing experience. Obviously, I was 21. I was fairly old to start dancing. I had no money at the time to fund myself. But I just really knew I wanted to do it. Talking about fire in the belly, I was like, I'm going to do this, whatever it takes. So I would work every evening and every weekend to fund myself. And then luckily, after one term, they gave me a scholarship. So they recognized how hard I was working. They recognized how dedicated I was. And then I got a scholarship. And then from there, I toured for a bit, well, for 5 years till I was 30. I toured as a dancer. I actually toured with an Irish show, ironically, Lord of the Dance type show, not quite the Lord of the Dance. But I was one of the guys that did the splits and kicked my legs, and everyone's like, wow, that's amazing. Oh my god, that's so cool. You know, I was one of those guys. I definitely wasn't one of the Irish dancers because I didn't know how to do that. But I definitely had a real love for that type of dancing. I really still do really love the rhythm and the music. And then I got injured, you know, typical dancer story. I did my back in, took a year out to recover, to come back. And then first class back, last exercise, my back went again. And that's kind of when I knew, well, my dance career was over, because I didn't have the tools then that I have now, and I didn't have that mindset. You just assume, as it's such a bad injury and as it's come back, that things aren't going to be good again. And, you know, it's a real shame, because I really got to that point where, as a dancer, you know, people were calling me up. You know, you get to that kind of offer only status where people call you and say, hey, we want you to audition, or we've got a part for you, or we've got this, we want you to come in and do. And I got there, and that's when my back went. And from then on, that's where I found myself, you know, I found myself doing various things. I tried to get a TV show commissioned. I launched a fashion label that didn't go very far. I did PR for a modeling agency, which was great. That I really enjoyed that. PR for modeling agencies, that was fabulous, you know. And then, I don't know, I just kind of turned my back on all that and then ended up working in catering for a while and ended up doing fundraising on the phones, you know, being one of those people who tried to get donations out of people. And then I found myself at a call center. And then from the call center, I ended up in training. And that's kind of, training was a mini substitute for dancing, because I was in front of people. I was still kind of training them to do things. And then I got plucked and pulled across to another company that worked with some massive brands. And that's kind of the journey. And that's how I found coaching. And that's from there, it kind of all evolved. And my whole personal development journey started. But I think it really started when I started as a dancer. You know, if ever you need to, on a daily basis, deal with the demons in your head, you need to deal with what you look like and fight your body at the same time. That's dance will do that for you.
How did dancing serve you?
Actually, recently, I released a whole article about this in a magazine. I talked about what it taught me about business. And I think fundamentally there's some key similarities, timekeeping, respect, never underestimating the basics and the need to always look at the basics, surrounding yourself with people that will support you, accept the people. There'll be plenty of people out there who won't, and there'll be plenty of people out there who are your competitors, you know, rising above the noise, be more giraffe. You learn a lot about rejection, and you learn that actually, while it might feel personal, it's not. You just didn't fit into an image, look, feel, or, you know, you're just not the guy that did it before that's left. Learned a lot about that. You learn about hard work, you know, because dancing is, you know, there's no faking it. You can't fake dancing. You can't post your results on dancing and pretend that you've made 100,000 when you made a tenner. Like, it's all based on work ethics, based on your attitude. And those are some of the things I still carry with me today. You know, I still don't believe in burning bridges, even though people out there can be terrible people. I always believed in leaving a job with respect, regardless if I got on with them or not. And I keep that. You know, when I have calls or meetings, I will judge the person by the person and not by the website or what I've read. And that's, again, when you're dancing or you know, you want to work for a choreographer or something, you judge them for their work. You judge them for who they are. You don't go there, look at their website and go, oh, that's a great website, you know. So those are some things that it's taught me. I kind of wish I was better with money back then. I was more savvy, because I did have one particular job where, you know, accommodation was paid, food was paid, and it was all in my pocket. And I didn't save any of it, you know, and that's just part of the journey. But I wish back then I was just more savvy, because I could have come off that tour and probably bought a house, but I didn't actually have any. I came off that tour in poor, even though I didn't burn the relationship, it wasn't a good me leaving. And actually, I left being owed money, and we tried to pursue it, but obviously, because I wasn't in that country anymore, it didn't matter. So I never saw that money. But yeah, I just wish I was savvier when it came to dealing with my money. But, you know, I wanted to be an artist. I want to be creative. It wasn't about the money. But there we go. So any dancers out there right now, be savvy with your money.
It's true, right? Because you are the product as well, right? You know, so... as you say, you hurt your elbow, you hurt your leg, you know, you need to be physically turning up, you need to be mentally turning up, you gotta, you know, there's the dedication, there's the practice and everything else. So it's full on. It's not like an e-product as such, or, you know, a platform that can replay while you sleep. It's, you know, you either are dancing and getting paid or you're not, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just, I don't know, it's such a shame that I'd reached that kind of like level and boom. And I think that was part of the reason back then also I went to a fairly dark place. It's like, because I was like, oh, because all dancers dream of that. They dream of that, getting the phone call, inviting them. And you work very hard to get there. And then when you're finally there, it's like, boom, sorry, my body's given up on me. Oh, great. Thanks, body. You know? But again, that taught me. It all matters now, but of course you can only deal with what's in front of you. But taught me some harsh lessons.
I mean, is there an element there of, you know, just wanting to be seen by the universe? Because, you know, I'm conscious there of, you know, you mentioned the sort of the divorce, and you mentioned the sexual abuse, and, you know, there's all sorts there where it's almost like your true self just wants to be seen for who you are, as opposed to all the other stuff.
It's a very deep question. I think that I've always said I want respect from peers, I guess who I consider peers. Yeah, I think there's a desire for acknowledgement, and there's a want to be seen for who I am for the right reasons. So I think you probably answer something there, yeah?
No, it's always interesting with different people, because with some you sort of find, you know, they talk about, you know, your void being your value, you know, which is always an interesting concept, you know, as well. You know, and I talk about this sort of the midlife opportunity, you know, you talk about the midlife crisis, the midlife whatever, you know, but it's also, it is, right? You know, it's a chance to sort of let go of baggage and see. But what's your take there?
Of which part of that one?
Well, I suppose it's the, you know, when your void becomes your value, you know, it's how do you be sure that this is actually genuinely what you want, and it's not trying to be seen or do something else? You know, how do you sort of do the sniff test, if you like? I don't know where that came from, but.
Sniff test. Well, I mean, I guess it depends if you count your experience in life as a void. Or you're referring to them as two separate concepts. Because what I'm getting from that is your void is your value, i.e. are you saying what's missing is what we aspire?
Potentially, yes. I mean, we you know, through I'm not saying it's the case, but some people might say, well, so money's generally a good one. You know, it's like why, you know, people become tenacious, you know, when they sort of, it might be that there was a lack of money in their childhood and, you know, they had to do without or whatever. They were very conscious of these values. So they become this sort of money hungry, mad entrepreneur. And listen, there's a brilliant strength to have, but it's kind of going, is that what you want? Or do you just never want to be short of money?
Right. So I see what you mean. Yeah, I think, you know, as long, I mean, a great example is my dad, right? So he's a recovering alcoholic. And when I started this journey into personal development, one of my whole things was, you know, I want to be successful because I don't want to be like my dad, right? So, but of course, that's a moving away behavior. I'm doing something not to be like versus moving towards, which is, here's who I want to become, and this is what I want to create in my life. I think as long as we use the voids to drive us in a positive, in an empowering way, then it's of value. But if it's used destructively, because taking your example of, you know, that person that might have lacked money and they become a money crazy, hungry entrepreneur, which is most entrepreneurs, by the way. But if they're only solely driven by money, then it's never enough. And that's a very, very dark vacuum, right? That's a very, very hard void to ever fill. You'll never feel fulfilled. And, you know, you can see some of that behavior around us that it's never enough. But at some point, you know, I believe someone, if they do have the right kind of journey, the right in brackets, then at some point it will not be about the money. And it's about something greater than that. Are there entrepreneurs out there who are terribly evil and do terrible things? Yes, there are, of course. Are there entrepreneurs out there that do great stuff? There are. I think it's understanding the void and how it drives you and the both sides to it, because you can't have one without the other, right? If you're going to have polarities, you can't have good without the bad. You can't have bad without the good, and they coexist within each other. So for me, it's quite interesting because is my void my value? I think they're definitely a driver, and I think they keep my ambition alive, and I think they keep me going, what I perceive to be missing, but I'm equally appreciative of what I have. And I think using my voids and my value, yeah, I think that as long as I'm doing good with that and I'm not harming the world and I'm not hurting people, I think that can be a very positive driver. What's missing or perceived to be missing depends on whose school of thought you go with and who's training. But, you know, if I look at right now, there's certain aspects that are missing, but I don't use that to beat myself up or to deprive myself or to judge myself. I use it to drive myself.
What are you capable of?
Generally?
Sure.
Many things. It's very hard to quantify and understand, like, in what capacity, what am I capable of? I think, I'm capable of many, many things I put my mind to. I can't fly. I'll never be able to fly because we're just not physically built to flap wings. But I can certainly achieve great things as long as I stick to it and accept that, you know, challenge is part of the process and pain is part of the process, part of the growth. But I'm capable of most things. I'm not capable of crazy mathematical equations. but I can solve most problems. I might not be able to build a rocket, but I can certainly encourage people who are, and I can help them be able to communicate why they are building rockets and what is their thought behind it and how they've told the story of how they decided to build a rocket. You know, I can certainly empower my children to be the best version of themselves on a daily basis. Yeah.
Is that your superpower? To empower?
Empower. I still think it's my ability to help people communicate what they want to say and how they want to say it. I do think there is a huge element to me that is empowering people. Depends how many superpowers we're allowed to have here, Mighty Pete. You know, it really does depend.
Well, it's like the old thing that people used to say, you know, it's like, if I can give you three wishes, of course, the kids would always be like, I wish for 1,000 more wishes. You're like, well,
you can't have that now. Yeah, I think, you know, I am a real empath, and one of my key things is to support people. And I do believe in supporting the right people to their greatness. So, yes, there's a strength of me that's able to empower people and believe in themselves. So that's one of my superpowers. But my biggest superpower, you know, is to help people be able to communicate what they need to communicate in their language. I think that's my greatest superpower.
Do you think, I mean, would you say speakers are speakers born or are they created?
Created. I believe anybody can become a speaker. It's a skill. It's a skill. You can learn it just like riding a bike, just like driving, although some people will never be able to drive. Some people will never be able to speak, right? But most people can learn. It's a skill. It's a skill, you know. It's like anything. You can learn it. Do some people have more charisma than others? Yes. Are people more, certain people more natural at it than others? Yes. But that doesn't mean you're in the admitted club. Right, anybody can.
It's so true, isn't it? I mean, just getting, you know, deciding that, you know, to be you, you know, it's decide not to be, and, you know, there's so many great speakers out there that people try and be a version of somebody else, right? You know, and they sort of go, well, I want to speak like him or her or whatever.
Yeah, you can take bits of other speakers and then you mold it to become you. But yeah, like too many people try and be Tony Robbins and it's so blatantly obvious and it doesn't work. It's clunky. You can see it doesn't quite work. It is about forming the best version of yourself. But for that, you do need to model other speakers to begin with until you find your way of delivery.
Who do you look at as, I mean, sort of very powerful speakers?
It's a good question because it depends what I'm looking at them as. Like, what are they communicating as speakers? Obviously, yeah, we mentioned Tony Robbins. Is he a great speaker? Is he a great motivator? You know, he's way up there. Like, how he obviously holds the room. Story, although now his voice is all messed up, but, you know, storytelling, like, he's way up in the 1%, and there's a reason why he's done it and where he is, right? Obviously, you know, there's some other great speakers out there. You know, if you look at the Martin Luther King and his ability, not just in that one speech, but if you watch other speeches of his, you know, his ability to communicate. I mean, he's a very different, he's a preacher, right? So it's a very different way of speaking. I find Simon Sinek a really great speaker as well. Because what he's able to do as a speaker is able to take something awfully complex and make it simple. And that's a real skill. And be able to communicate that in a way that's so crystal clear that it lands is a real excellent skill as well. He's a great speaker. I really enjoy, more because I enjoy his intelligence, you know, John DeMartini. I think John DeMartini is interesting because if you look at him technically as a speaker, he would never say, admit this, but he could do some work, right? Especially when he speaks so fast. But when you look at the content he delivers and his physical delivery, it's very clever. It's very good. So when you break him down, I'm thinking, you know, Steve Jobs was an amazing storyteller, right? Absolutely brilliant speaker. There's not many people in the world that can sell you something that you don't quite get, you don't understand, and no one's seen, and everybody would go crazy to buy it without understanding what they're buying. And that is world class. Again, 1%, very few can do what Steve Jobs was able to do. Again, great storyteller, great corporate storyteller. In fact, with his teams, if people showed up with slides, he'd send them away and go, if you can't tell me a story about it, don't pitch it to me, right? You've got to be able to tell me the story behind this. So I think he's a great speaker. You know, and then there's the kind of the ones that have rallied people like Malala, and then you got Emma Watson. Am I getting her name wrong? Used to be in Harry Potter, right?
Yeah, Emma Watson, yeah.
Yeah, she, again, that's a great speak. You know, she's a great speaker when it comes to delivering things of, you know, matters of the heart. Ken Robinson, obviously, God bless his soul, one of the most watched heads. Excellent. Ralph Fiennes is a great speaker because he's more of a comedian because he's just like one-liners. He just like, but he bashes it out and, you know, that's his style. He's just like one-liners, very funny, very funny, very funny, very funny. Those are some people I can think of, but they're all very distinctly very different speakers, right? Because they speak, when we look at things, you can speak to sell a product or promote a brand and a service. That's a different skill set from the Ralph Fiennes or from the Ken Robbins when you're a keynote speaker. Different, right? But those are some of the people I can think about that really get me when I watch them speak.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, you sort of categorize there. So, I mean, whether it be a keynote speaker or a presentation speaker, you have a motivational speaker, you have, I don't know, I mean, they were just a couple that I picked up. I mean, so I hadn't really even thought about that. It's quite interesting.
There is a difference, right? There's you being a speaker, and then there's you speaking to promote. They're different. And this is where a lot of people, you know, like Tony Robbins, right? Yes, he's motivational, he's inspirational. He uses speaking to sell. If we strip it right back, right, he speaks. I mean, obviously he wants to empower people. He's empowered millions of people. Let's forget what you do or don't think about him. But, you know, ultimately he uses 3 or 4 days to sell onto other products while adding huge value, changing people's lives. Massive impact. The ultimate outcome is to sell, right? If you look at the likes of Ken Robinson or you look at Sheryl Sandberg, the former CEO of Facebook, who wrote LinkedIn, Karen Brady, keynote speaker, right? Ralph Fiennes, keynote speaker. It's like, I have achieved something extraordinary. I'm going to tell you about it. I'm going to entertain you. I'm going to get handsomely paid. But there's no agenda. Like, that's it. I'm coming in 45 minutes, boom, 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 boom. Thank you very much. I mean, they might sell a book, but there's no like enrollment into, you know, can you imagine Deborah Meaden going, well, you know, I'm now not so Deborah Meaden or Karen Brady. Let's go, Karen, you know, hey guys, talk about The Apprentice. And at the end of this, I'm running a 3-day training. So in the end of this keynote, if you want to hear more about, go to the back of the room. Right? It'd be really weird. Plus she gets 50+K per keynote. So she doesn't need to sell, if not more now. Right? So it is very different. You can be Mighty Pete the speaker, and you can be Mighty Pete the speaker that uses, you know, the user speaking to sell. And they are very different skill sets. And a lot of people make that mistake. And a lot of people, even the pandemics, people that were speakers, can you see I took my hands, right? People who are speakers now having to sell are really struggling. Because they're not used to having to promote, to sell at the end of it. And it is a different skill set. Who are the speakers that inspire you out of interest?
What's that, sorry?
Who are the speakers that inspire you out of interest?
I was interested when you were talking about, you know, Dr. John D. Martini and having, I mean, I've sort of seen, you know, seen him speak and things like that. And it's interesting you say he's maybe not the strongest outward performer. However, the content, I mean, it sort of literally, you know, for me, it just blew my mind, you know.
But class.
I mean, it sets you off on this thought process and journey. And, you know, you just, I'm sort of, if you're a scribbler, I jot stuff down, you know, but to the point I just find myself, I stop because it's like my brain hurts too much.
Yeah, it's impossible, especially, that's what I mean. You know, he's a great speaker. The way he embodies physicality when he's making a point, what I'm sure he's been told is about his pacing, because his mind works so fast, it's very hard to keep up with him. And that's what I mean. Technically, you would work with him on slowing him down and be able to still keep that kind of upbeat energy, but get the points across a bit more. But he's amazing. Yeah. I mean, his content is world class.
Is that, and I mean, I don't know, I'm attracted, and maybe we are attracted to people that we are like, or we think we are, you know. And I think of Jordan Peterson, you know, not necessarily, you know, the, what was it, 12 Rules for Life, and but his whole lecture series, which is, he's not sort of there to be, it kind of come across, he's not trained to speak as such, you know, but now as a lecturer, he probably is. But I, again, I'm more enthralled by the content. So I don't know whether that says more about him or more about me as the listener. I don't know.
Well, I think ideally, I mean, if we're going to use speaking to sell, we're going to use speaking to entertain, you know, you still want the content to be amazing, but you want it to be delivered in an impactful way. And then the language that lands, right, which is, again, having the right structure. So some people do speaking because they need to. It's like, oh, so let me go. I need to do this. And you can see they're kind of like half-baked. I remember watching a guy, you know, who was fairly famous on the radio, and then he embarked on these kind of like the personal development space. And I watched him speak, and you could just tell he didn't enjoy it. He said the right things and he did okay, but he just didn't enjoy the whole speaking side of things. And you can tell that. And if your content's very good, then people might be forgiving. But again, because there's so many people now who are both great content and great presenters, then, you know, you'll be more drawn to them. You know, John's very charismatic. You can't take that away. I mean, I don't know about Peterson, to be completely honest. It's just a better combination. when you love it and you've got great content, it's more engaging for the person watching.
Absolutely. I mean, there is so much there. It makes a lot of sense. Tell me, what's a bit of a guilty pleasure for you there, Elliot?
I think Arsenal is a bit of a guilty pleasure. Watching, I know, that's kind of, I love that. It's just my getaway. It's 2 hours where I have no control. I can scream a little bit at the phone or the TV when I'm watching it. Even my little girl now sits, Arsenal winning. And often the case is, no, they're not winning because they're not very good right now. But what else is my guilty pleasure? That's a good question. I don't know if I have too many guilty pleasures. I do enjoy the sweeter side of things in life. You know, I guess that's a guilty pleasure, but I don't feel guilty. Because I know I'm consciously eating it and I'm going to enjoy it. I don't overindulge when I have it. So I got to think about it. That was my guilty pleasure.
What's your go-to on the sweet stuff?
Good question. I really like, I'm not vegan, but I don't eat dairy and I'm allergic to nuts. So I really like a good vegan ice cream that tastes like real ice cream, but I can have. I think that's probably my go-to. So a good vegan, nut-free, dairy-free, with taste ice cream is my probably go-to thing when it comes to that.
That sounds like it could be quite far along the ice cream aisle. It's like to get your full shopping list.
Because even when you find the vegan one, I can't have coconut either. So I might go, oh, yeah. And then it's like, oh, coconut. Like, no. Why me? You see, then my victim comes out. I'm like, why me with the ice cream? No, I'm joking about the victim bit. Yeah, that's probably my biggest go-to guilty pleasure. So not very harmful.
Talk to us about inner voices.
What do you want them to say? Which one? Inner voices. Well, you know, I think we all have them, unless I'm the only insane one that you've interviewed. I think there's always a variety of inner voices. I think there's the empowering one. There's a disempowering one. I think the more you work on yourself and the more you do kind of the personal development stuff, the more you, and you know, there's no utopic ending, right? We don't end like, oh, I've arrived. Everything's great. I'm all perfect now, right? It's a continuous journey. I do think the more you're on this journey and you work on yourself, the more you're able to distinguish between the disempowering and the empowering one. You're able to make peace with the disempowering one, except it's going to be there, but not let it control you. And but when you are feeling down, it's often a bit louder than the empowering one, which is why having a connection to something greater than yourself is important. But yeah, I think inner voices are here to stay. They're not going anywhere. But it's also not about getting rid of your negative voices. Right. I think it's learning to live with them and learning not to listen to them, because they're not going to go away. And I think if you set yourself up with the illusion that you can get rid of them or stop them, then they'll get louder and you'll get more disappointed. Right. excuse me. And I think the more you can embrace them, accept them, then the softer they become.
It's always amazing, you know, the different inner, you know, because some people say, well, you know, if I say I hear voices, it's kind of going, they're going to look at me. Whereas you go, do you have an inner critic? And like, oh yeah, yeah, I have one of those. Like, okay, well,
yeah,
inner critic, inner voice, call it what you want. It seems to be quite common there. You know, there's a good guy and a bad guy, or a good person, bad person. You know, and there's sort of this juxtaposition that goes on in people's heads. That seems to be quite a common thing, right?
Yeah, I mean the whole Jekyll and Hyde thing. Yeah, not to that extreme, of course. But, you know, we all have that. I mean, again, if we're talking about John's work, you can't have one without the other, right? You can't have an empowering voice without a disempowering voice. You can't have, you know, one exists within the other. And I think what happens is for a lot of people is they allow the disempowering voice to dominate. And that's where it's dangerous.
I mean, as an overall concept and where you're at in your life, I mean, are you in a sort of a towards energy or an away from energy? Where are you at in your life?
I think now, while I'm frustrated with things, I'm a lot more in the towards space. At times it feels like the government's in an away space and they're doing everything they can to keep you there. But that's just about us rising up beyond that. It's definitely towards, because if it wasn't, then I wouldn't be getting up every day and sitting in this cave, which is my office, and coming up with Be More Giraffe and, you know, coming up with all these things to maintain the momentum forwards, you know.
Where's your happy place then in the business? I mean, are you know, you talk a lot about creating there and making and things like that as well.
Well, the happy place, I believe, is when I'm training and when I'm speaking, right? That's my happy place. Love it. Do it. All the time. When I'm seeing people results, that makes me happy. My happiness doesn't depend on it though, but it makes me happy. For example, tonight one of the people I've worked with, they're going to be on MasterChef, the professionals, and they did really well. I'm probably not going to say who they are, but you know, the funny thing is when that person contacted me, she's like, hey, finished filming. I'm like, oh, you made it on there then? She goes, oh yeah, didn't I tell you? I'm like, no. But we've been in touch since, obviously. And, you know, that's my happy place, right? My happy place is training, my happy place is speaking, my happy place is hearing results. But, you know, I don't put my whole happiness to depend on that, which is what a lot of people do. And when I was depressed, I realized that's something I did. I really relied on my clients' results to feel good. And then I got over that, which is a good thing.
It's such a thing, you know, how do you, you know, preserve energy? So you give energy, but don't necessarily, you know, sort of live off the rebound. You know, you're happy enough to go, well, I've given, I'm done. Exactly. You know, people may or may not, people may take it and run and take over the world. Someone may take it and throw it in the bin, but it's outside of my control right now, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got to let go.
What's, in one or two words then, what's your fire in the belly?
In one or two words, drive and focus.
I like that.
Always has been.
Where can people find out more about you, Elliot?
After this, if they still want to. After everything I've told them, of course. Well, there's... you can, of course, there's the Instagram. You can follow me, Speaker Express, or I am Elliot K, E-L-L-I-O-T-K-A-Y. That's on the gram. On Twitter, again, very similar, Speaker Express, or I am Elliot K on Twitter. Facebook, find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, Elliot K, E-L-L-I-O-T-K-A-Y. And, you know, if you really want to reach out, you can also find my books on Amazon if you want to reach it. So Speak, Influence, Sell is my latest one. And then Power to Succeed. I think those are the two that are worth reading. The other two are okay, but I wouldn't worry too much about them. And then if you really, really want to reach out, have a chat about anything, just you feel free to drop me an email. So hello@speakerexpress.co.uk. And it, you know, just have an informal chat or chat, whatever you want. I mean, however I can serve you and support you, reach out. And if I can't, I probably know someone who can. That's how people can find out about me.
Awesome. Final message?
My final message is this. Hell is meeting the person you could have been. Heaven is meeting the person you did become. Think about that. Be seen, be heard, and always use your voice for good. That's my message.
Elliot, thank you so much for sharing.
Thanks for having me. Great questions.
Till the next time, take care. Goodbye.
Well, that was another great episode of Fire in the Belly. You know, this really wouldn't be possible without our great guests taking the time to share their personal journeys. And boy, oh boy, sometimes it is personal. It's an absolute pleasure to have that, and then to hear the journeys that people have been on. We've loads more episodes coming up soon, and it's always a pleasure to have guests on. If you do happen to know anyone with true fire in their belly, please reach out to us so we can share their journey, lessons, and successes. So, all that's left to say is have a great day, live with fire in your belly, and be the mightiest version of you.